Welcome back to the Pistols Firing Podcast. This is Kyle Porter. I'll be joined shortly by Carson Cunningham and a very special guest that we had on today. Just want to take a second to thank you guys for listening, for following the blog. That's been the biggest month that we've ever had at Pistols Firing. The most page views, most visitors. It's been a fun month, obviously, with Oklahoma State playing kind of well and winning a lot. So appreciate you guys following, making the website what it is, and let's get you right to the podcast.
Welcome back to the Pistols Firing Podcast. I'm Carson Cunningham, joined by Kyle Porter, and we have a special guest today. It's Thursday, so we have a guest, Evan Epstein, former offensive lineman for Oklahoma State, was there from 2009 through 2012. Evan, thanks for joining us, man.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the chance to come on and talk about Oklahoma State. It's one of my favorite topics, as most people know, probably.
Yeah, I feel like you have one of the more so a lot of, I guess, athletes or former athletes that I follow on Twitter or wherever. It's kind of like, okay, whatever. Like but I feel like your Twitter feed is very insightful. You've got a lot of good takes on players and just kind of like the playing experience. Is that something that, I mean, do you enjoy doing that? Have you thought about going into broadcasting or like being an analyst with stuff like this?
I've never thought about it. I've never had too many opportunities, post playing to do anything like what we're doing now, for example. But, tweeting about our football team, I love it. I love talking about sports. I love talking about football in general. I mean, obviously, it's a passion of mine. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it for as long as I did. Before, when I still thought I was going to go into coaching or still thought I was going to play in the NFL or whatever, I kind of held back a little bit. And, when I was just playing, I had to be conservative with what I tweeted. And, my mom does executive communications for a living, so she is hawking my Twitter. And if I say one thing wrong, she could probably log in herself and delete it. So before I had to be pretty, pretty calm with what I was saying. But now that I'm just working and just kind of a regular person, I let loose a little bit. But I think it's only fair. I got insight into a program that a lot of people want to know about and are traditionally just, pretty quiet. A lot of the stuff that you hear from Oklahoma State comes through, the media department or the guys that have been reporting on it for years and years and years. So it's not every day that you get someone like me who's been there and understands a little bit what's going on. And we'll actually talk about it in a relatively free sense. I'm sure there's a lot of Oklahoma State fans think I'm a crotchety former player, but I promise that's not the case.
I almost didn't recognize you from your Twitter picture. You used to have the long locks, you used to weigh a lot more. What's it been like transitioning from the playing career to
I don't want to talk about the hair, Carson. We can't talk about the hair. I'm still not over it. No, it's been fun. Obviously I had a blast with the long hair and that whole kind of persona in playing college football. And it's nice to be able to wake up and do nothing but football, and school, obviously. But, losing weight has been something I always wanted to do. So I lost, when I finally said, okay, no more playing, I'm not going to try to do the NFL or anything. I weighed like 310, 315, and I weigh 245 right now. So that was something that I always wanted to do. And the hair cutting, there's only so many jobs where you can look like, a hipster biker or something or whatever I looked like.
What was your, after you were done at Oklahoma State tell me about the experience of trying to get into the NFL and just everything that goes along with that. What was it like for you? I can't think back to what happened there, but what was it like for you?
Well, it was tough. I mean, you work your whole life, and especially coming from Texas, you play football. That's what you do. And you work your whole life towards a goal. I wanted to play in the NFL. I mean, that's what I planned on doing. I never thought about, well, what if I didn't? I always try to get good grades, and school was always very important to me. So it wasn't like, I'm Booby Miles or anything like that, but I had no doubt in my mind that I was going to play in the NFL. And I got really damn close. And I can make whatever excuses that I make, but my opinion, I didn't have enough years on film to be valuable as an offensive lineman. And I wasn't really big enough to be valuable as an offensive lineman in the NFL, if you can believe that. We were system players at Oklahoma State. We played a spread system. We were very fast. We were very conditioned. And with the exception of my guards, you know, myself as a center and our tackles, we were in really good shape and we were not very big. And I had two really big, really athletic guards next to me to cover that up. Lane Taylor was the one that had to be physical, not me. I just had to make the right calls. He made me look wonderful every play. And that might trick a lot of people, but I guess it didn't trick the NFL. So, you know, I got to training camp and I went to Miami a year before Clint did and had really good feedback on my performance and just never got signed. And went into coaching, did that whole thing out in New Mexico with a couple former players and decided I'd give it one more try and do pro day again at Oklahoma State and try to do one of the regional combines and ended up getting hurt. And that was kind of a sign for me. You know, I realized I can keep doing this thing and trying to get on a team and maybe get practice squad somewhere down the road, get a break. Or, you know, if it doesn't work out, I'm going to be wasting years of my life and years of a career doing something that will probably make me not be able to walk or sleep very well in the near future. So it was kind of a personal decision, and I kind of didn't know what to do for a long time after that. You know, what do you do if all you know is one thing for so many years? But luckily, I found the job that I'm doing now, which I love. I just actually got done taking my LSAT two Saturdays ago. So kind of have a vision and a path going forward now, and things have come together for me, which allows me to sit on my couch on Saturdays and, and tweet little snippets of snark at our Oklahoma State Cowboys.
What job do you have now? What are you doing right now?
I work for a company called ProBuild Builders Force. So we're like the largest lumber and building materials distributor in the world, which is really cool. So I sell stuff for them. So I work with home builders, custom home builders, and trying to get them the best products to build their houses with. So we're all over the country, and I'm in the Dallas office, but there's an Oklahoma City branch, and those are some of the finest people I've ever worked with. And that's kind of really why I love my job more than anything. It's not necessarily what I do. I love sales, and I think it plays to my personality, but I work with really great people, and that made me feel like I was back home on the football team because I played with great people, and that's how you get through adverse situations, and kind of the same feeling now. So I really enjoy it.
You had an interesting journey to Stillwater. You went to Air Force for a year, and you weren't playing football, correct?
No, I was. Right? I was playing football.
You were playing football? Okay, well, yeah. You go to Air Force for a year and then transferred to Oklahoma State. Just tell us how that all came about and how you ended up in Stillwater.
Well, it was a really lucky thing. I knew of Oklahoma State. Joe Wickline recruited me heavily out of high school. They didn't end up offering me because I never went to one of those. They like those satellite camps. Oklahoma State does a lot of satellite camps all over the country, and one of the biggest ones is in Dallas. Obviously, there's a lot of recruits down here, and I told Joe that I was going to a different one other than the Oklahoma State one that same weekend. And as you can imagine, for those of you guys who know Joe Wickline, he did not appreciate that and never ended up offering me a scholarship. And I don't know. I take a lot of my experiences from my grandfather. He played at Notre Dame, and he, you know, halfway through his Notre Dame career, he had to go to the Korean War. You know, luckily there's no super major wars like that we have to worry about sending college kids to. But you know, that's what he had to do in his time, and he's kind of a personal hero of mine. He always talked about how him going to the Marine Corps is what made him a man and changed him and got him on the playing field at Notre Dame and got him to where they're playing for championships. And he was playing with Heisman Trophy winners and he was starting both ways. And he's always spoke fondly of that experience where a lot of people could have taken it as a, you know, a bad thing. And I don't know, that always stuck with me. So coming out of high school, I had good grades. I had a lot of Ivy League offers, a lot of smaller schools, some Big 12s like Iowa State and Kansas, and but all of the service academies offered me, and I just kind of fell in love with it. I took a visit there. It was my first and only visit was to the Air Force Academy, and I just fell in love with it. I fell in love with the people there. Not too many people know Coach Singleton was actually there. He was one of the people that helped recruit me on my visit. I just fell in love with it, and you know, little did I know that I had no idea what the triple option was. I was a high school kid. you know, I'm going to try to pancake whoever's in front of me that's not wearing the same stuff that I am. I didn't know what offensive strategy was. So, you know, I go from a spread high school to the triple option, which I don't know if you guys know, but Air Force Academy likes their offensive linemen at like 230, 240. I went into basic training at 295.
That's crazy.
Wow. You know, suffered through that. I came out as a skinny fat kid. Not sure if you guys are familiar with the skinny fat body archetype, but it's not very athletic. So, you know, got out of basic training, lost all my strength, didn't know what I was doing. And then, you know, with all this class load, all of the military load, now you have to go play football. And it was the toughest thing ever, and I wasn't ready for it. Not to take anything away from the coaches, but I don't think that the Air Force Academy coaches really let kids understand what they're really getting into. I think some yes and some no. Obviously, some people are very successful at the Air Force Academy. And let me tell you, no one should have anything but the utmost respect for the kids that can do that at any of the service academies. I just couldn't. It was either I was going to have to quit football to stay at the Air Force Academy or leave. So I chose to leave. And Oklahoma State was one of the places I called up. And they let me in under academic probation because my grades may or may not have dropped. I'm not going to confirm or deny that. And it just really worked out. I came in at a tough time. At a tough time as far as there was like 700 offensive linemen and they all looked like monsters compared to me. And people have heard me tell the story, but I walked in at Oklahoma State in 2009, August 4th, 2009, I believe was the date, for 2 days. And I was about 275 or something, finally getting some weight back from the Air Force. And, you know, these are Russell Okung's, Andrew Lewis's, Noah Franklin's, if anyone remembers that, Brady Bond, Andrew Mitchell, and then all the guys that came behind them on those really successful teams. And I remember calling my dad that first day and I said, Dad, I made a mistake. He's like, what are you talking about? I go, I'm never going to play here. These are the biggest humans I've ever seen in my life. They're all benching like thousands of pounds. Like I just had no idea, you know, Coach Glass was super mean to me. It was just a terrible experience for like the first month. But like anything, you know, you settle in and you start looking at things with different eyes. And, you know, everyone that I met here at Oklahoma State was just amazing. The students were amazing. The players were amazing. And it really became home for me, which is why I was able to be successful in the long run, I think.
That's it's interesting to hear that because, you know, you do have all these. I mean, that's kind of what Oklahoma State was really trying to build up at the time, their offensive line, the running game and everything. Which team that you played on had the best offensive line and the best running game?
No doubt my senior year, 2012. That might come as a surprise to some people. Everyone immediately thinks of the 2011 offense. You know, you're Weeden to Blackman as the best offense ever. And as far as maybe points scored, yes. But if you actually look at the statistics, we had a higher ranking offense my senior year. And we played so much longer together my senior year. That offensive line was myself, Lane Taylor, Brandon Webb, Daniel Koenig, and Parker Graham. Well, we were all, you know, young puppies on scout team together from day one, you know, with Clint Shelf as our quarterback. We grew up at Oklahoma State. We grew up in the system. We didn't even have to talk to each other. We just knew what everyone was going to do. You know, by that time, Lane Taylor was a 4-year starting veteran. He was a monster, you know. It made me look a hell of a lot better than I was. I mean, people thought I was a decent player. That's not the case. Let me tell you, I just tried to be smarter than everybody. I spent way too much time with Joe Wickline watching film, but I had, you know, two 330-pound guards covering for me and two tackles that ended up being all Big 12. And I think, you know, Lane was an All-American and made me look really, really good. But, you know, we were a family. You know, I talk to Clint Shelf to this day, as much as it pains me to admit, I love him to death. And we blocked for him like it. I talked to Joe Randall to this day. Love that kid to death. We blocked for him like it. We were a family. It's different when you're blocking because you have to, or you're blocking because your coach said so, or because you want to look good. it's different when you're blocking for someone because you love that person and you want them to be more successful than anything else. I blocked as hard as I could because I wanted Clint to throw a touchdown. I wanted Joe to break a 60-yard run. And that's why I think we had the best offense, and that's why I think we had the best running game. I would have to look at the stats to see if that was actually the truth, but there was no one that we couldn't score on. You know, we averaged the highest points per game, I think second highest in the country behind Oregon that year, but by far the highest in the Big 12.
No doubt.
And we, there still, was... we still lost five games, which, you know, that's another story. Don't ask about that.
That's a story we want to talk about.
I'll go on a rant, believe me.
Was there pressure on you, though, like taking over? You had to wait your turn to start at center, and there's some pressure in that because Andrew Lewis was a spectacular center. Grant Garner was the offensive lineman of the year in the Big 12. You're taking over for two guys that were really the quarterback of the offensive line and maybe a quarterback of the offense. I think Brandon Whedon gave Grant Garner a lot of credit. Was there some pressure on you knowing you were taking over that role?
Not at all, and here's why. Because I came behind two amazing centers, I knew what I was doing. I knew it was my time. I think I was nervous the first play of Savannah State. And then I think we scored on the first play probably. And as soon as that happened, I was good. I was ready to go. I had their blessing. I mean, Andrew Lewis came to me on one of those games and was like, "You're doing a great job. We're so proud of you." Same with some of those first guys, the guys that I was talking about when I called my dad and said, "I'm never going to play." They came and told me that I was doing a great job. And when that happens, there's no pressure. You know that you're supposed to be there. I knew our offense better than anyone. I had Coach Wicklund as a resource. We knew what we were doing. I knew what I was doing. There's no pressure. We just wanted to be the best team that we could be.
By the way, rushing yards per attempt, 2011, 5.39, 2012, 5.39.
Oh, okay. There we go.
So both. It was as good, if not better. I wanted to ask you about, you said something really interesting after the West Virginia game. You said Coach Gundy recruits and coaches players who don't ever give up, who never quit. Did you feel like, I mean, was that your favorite thing about playing for Gundy, or what was your favorite thing about him?
My favorite thing about Coach Gundy is he's truly a player's coach. I think he's much more effective as a head coach when he's not involved in the scheme. And that's not saying he doesn't know what he's doing with the scheme, because he ran the scheme when we played in the Heart of Dallas Bowl, and obviously we thrashed Purdue. He knows what he's talking about as far as football is concerned. But he's a player's coach. He calls meetings constantly and talks about leadership and taking care of each other and working hard and things that you think would be pretty standard. But, you know, Oklahoma State's traditionally had a hard time getting recruits when Texas was dominant and OU was dominant. You know, we were third, sometimes fourth in line, depending on whether Kansas State, or whoever was doing well. We've had to kind of fight and get kids that had chips on their shoulders. So that's the culture that has been built into Oklahoma State over the Gundy era. It's kids with chips on their shoulders. You know, I was a kid with a chip on my shoulder. I didn't get recruited by damn near anyone. And I had to walk on at Oklahoma State and earn my scholarship. I had chip on my shoulder against some of my teammates because of that stuff. So that's the culture that's still bleeding into the kids today. Now we get better recruits because it's a family. People want to play here. The fans are a huge part of that. I mean, we have such a great atmosphere. Then you add this culture that gets passed down from generation to generation of player that only kind of expands on that feeling. We're never beat. It doesn't matter what we go into halftime, because this is the legacy of teams that were down three touchdowns to A&M and came back and beat them at home. 2 years in a row, I think we were down to Texas A&M at halftime. Mm-hmm. We don't care what the score is. Gundy teams don't care what the score is. They don't care what the task is or who they're playing. We're going to play the best we can to win. And that's just the way it is. That's the way it was before I got there, and that's the way it is now. It might frustrate the hell out of some of us to be pulling our hair out like Dana Holgorsen, but, you know, those kids want to win games, and there's never a doubt in their mind that you were going to lose. The only game I've ever played in where we're like, man, we're probably going to lose, was Iowa State 2011.
Wow.
And if that tells you anything, yeah. So that's the culture that kids get to come in and play at. And that's why, you know, that's why we're 6-0.
I want to get to the Iowa State game, but first, what it was the biggest difference between Mike Gundy when he was the offensive coordinator and then when he was just the head coach? Because we all saw him sitting on the equipment trunk, I think, your freshman year. That's the only difference we saw. But as far as being inside the program, what was the biggest difference?
Well, you know, I think my freshman year was the only year he was still heavily involved with play calling, I believe. My freshman year, I was ineligible, so I didn't play or wasn't on varsity, just did the scout team stuff. But the biggest difference is we got better. You know, and that's an age-old kind of management thing, right? If you need to delegate to people that are specialists, you're the head football coach. You're an icon. You're a leader. You lead the culture of the team. The most successful head coaches in America today lead the culture of their teams. They set the system, so it doesn't matter who comes in or who leaves or who gets hurt. You set a system to be a champion, not micromanage the offense or defense or whatever. So that was the difference. You know, St. Holgerson came to us by way of Houston and imparted to Oklahoma State one of the most powerful and devastating offensive systems ever devised. From years and years and years, from Hal Mumme to why is his name escaping me?
Mike Leach?
Mike Leach, thank you. To Dana Holgerson, you know, to the best version of it, which I think was Todd Monken's version. That's what they gave us, and that's why it became unstoppable those last few years. Dana Holgerson's offensive system was designed for players that are not very good, designed for players that are not very athletic, really good pass routes, decent pass protection, lots of screens, lots of smoke and mirrors, because they had to. They're playing at Houston. They don't have the best players in the world. It's just the fact of the matter. And Todd Monken comes along and he goes, oh, crap. This is pretty smart. Oh, but wait, we have Brandon Whedon. We have Justin Blackman. We have NFL running backs. We have NFL offensive linemen. Let's tweak this a little bit and run the high power version of it that literally no one can stop, even if they know exactly what we're doing. So that's what came of Gundy stepping back.
I agree with all that. I think that's incredibly insightful. Why does Oklahoma State not still do that on offense? Why did they go away from that?
If you knew how many nights I laid awake thinking about that very question,
you're not alone.
You would think I was some sort of crazy person. Honestly, I have no idea. I really don't. And there's rumors and everyone's got their own theory, but it's almost like the old guys left, you know, the last person on staff that really knew the offense. I mean, honestly, Joe Wickline didn't even like our offense. He fought with Monken every day about how to run things. And that's, I mean, when Wick went to Texas to be the offensive coordinator, you didn't start seeing them put 60 points up like Baylor. They weren't running the same offense. They're running the power. They're running telltale Joe Wickline things. With maybe a little flair of spread. But so he wasn't even a fan of it. The last person on staff that truly grasped how powerful this offense is was Doug Meacham. And now you can see what he's doing. So quite simply, the answer I have for you is I have no idea. And it makes me sad because we have all of the things you need. And I assume we're going to talk about the offensive line at some point during this podcast, but we have an offensive line that can pass block. We have a quarterback that can throw it, and we have plenty of good receivers. There's no reason why we shouldn't be running that offense.
That was actually my next question, is what in the world, as a former offensive lineman, what is wrong with this current edition of the offensive line that you see?
I'm glad you asked this because, I mean, I knew you were going to ask this.
I'm going to go make a sandwich real quick. I'll be back in like 10 minutes.
No, honestly, I condensed it, and it's not going to be what you think. A lot of people ask me what's wrong with the offensive line. Obviously, I've tweeted several things that are not positive towards them, and that's mainly because I know those guys. I know what they're capable of, and people have thrown mud at Greg Adkins, and I don't think that's right. I know Coach Adkins is a good coach. I'm not sure if a lot of Oklahoma State fans know, but Coach Adkins was the offensive line coach for a record-setting Tennessee offensive line that threw some obscene amount of passes that year. He only gave up 4 sacks, which was a record. One of the best offensive lines in the decade, statistically at least, he coached. He knows what he's doing, everyone. He comes highly regarded, and the kids love him. The problem with our offensive line is not that they don't know who to block, because you can see that. Unfortunately for me, I haven't gotten to enjoy a football game since I started playing in college. I've been watching the games with my girlfriend. I'm like, oh, did you see that awesome touchdown pass? I'm like, no, I was watching the pass set of the left guard. He set too wide. Did you see it? And she'll look at me like I'm an alien or something. So all I watch is offensive line for the most part. And you could see from year over year, sorry, I'm using business terms, guys. I'm on the clock here. From last year to this year, the offensive line schematically is blocking so much better. They're getting on the right people. The pass blocking is really not that bad, at least as far as picking up blitzes and stunts and things that really mess up other offensive lines are not messing up our guys. Next time you guys watch, see if they do a line stunt or a blitz. And most of the time it's picked up. That's really good, everyone. Believe me, that's some of the hardest stuff to do. And run blocking. Why is the run blocking atrocious? They're blocking people. They're on people. So what does that mean? Is that Coach Atkins? No. When Wickline left, there was a bubble that collapsed. And just this kind of inherent softness took over. And I blame Coach Bob Conley, because I know that when he left, he tried to be the coach that Wickline wasn't. Wickline, you know, we all love him now, but he was cold. He wasn't very personable when we played with him. And you kind of have to be that way as far as, you know, in my opinion, as an offensive line coach. This isn't a fun position. No one plays offensive line for fun. When you go out on Thursday and you have a Thanksgiving football game, no one says, hey, let's play offensive line. No, it's just let's throw the ball and catch it because that's fun. So you have to have a group of evil people coaching evil people to be successful. Our offensive line is not evil. They block like their hands are made of loaves of bread. And that's our problem. They're not violent. There's no violence. They're just trying to block people, and you're never going to be successful when you do that. When you block people, you have to be extremely violent and hateful. That's the only way to be successful on run blocking. It's the most violent thing ever. It doesn't matter if it's a zone, outside zone. When you snap that ball, whoever's in front of you, maybe you do, maybe you don't, but that's the only way to maybe you do. Does that make sense? And that's why I think that we're not being very successful. But the good news is, the good news and the bad news is that it can be fixed by new people coming in, and it can't be fixed unless we get new people in. Softness is extremely hard to coach, especially when there's guys that have been there for years. I'm not really familiar with Salako. I've never met him. I've watched him quite a bit. But I know the rest of those guys, and I know what they're capable of. I remember Paul Lewis when he was a true freshman. I remember Mike Wilson when he was a true freshman. I remember Crabtree. I worked out with Crabtree one summer. I don't know if people understand how similar Brad Lundblade's story and my story are. You know, we're both kids from the Metroplex. We both went to private school. We both walked on. We're both centers. We both had to earn our scholarship. We both trained with the same offensive line mentor in Dallas. I knew Lundblade before he even went to Oklahoma State. So I know these guys, and I know what they're capable of, and that's why I get so frustrated, because they're better and they're more violent than what they've shown. And they'd probably, you know, every single one of those guys would admit that if we were sitting here talking to them. I know they would. They're good kids, and they know what they're doing.
I think it's interesting that you talk about it as a cultural problem, because I think that a lot of Oklahoma State fans would say the most common response is with, you know, the offensive coordinator or whatever, but it sounds like you feel like it's more of a culture issue that was created last year than anything that's really happening incorrectly with the offensive scheme this year.
Absolutely. And it's not that I think. I know it's a culture problem that was created last year. When Wickline left and Bob Conley and his, you know, giving up 40 sacks of glory came in, he tried to be the friendly offensive line coach and come over to the house, and everything Wickline said was wrong. And I'm a little biased. I love Joe Wickline. He was a huge part of my life for many years. But from what I've heard from the guys that were there, him coaching like that offensive linemen are we're lazy characters. We are. If you let us be lazy, we'll be lazy. I know we will. And that's what it seemed like it, last year. People were just lazy blocking. Didn't really care. There was no pride. And it's better this year, but you can still see it. You can see it in the blocking. And I don't expect everyone to be able to see it. It's something that you can – you just have to watch film and understand offensive linemen and be in that room to really get it. But, you know, if you called Lane Taylor and asked him, he'd say the same thing. You called Levy Adcock, he'd say the same thing. Any of those guys would say the same thing. Because it's very apparent. They're not blocking with pride. They're just blocking to block. And blocking to block is what gets you 1 yard per carry or giving up sacks.
It's obvious to me that Joe Wickline was very important to you. Just why do you think he left, and how hard has it been for you to see him kind of squabbling with Oklahoma State over the whole contract deal?
You know, I think he left because he got a better job offer. I mean, he knows Charlie. He's known Charlie Strong for many years. He was the last person on staff from the original Gundy hire. You know, it's hard to turn down that money at another big time school and get a chance to show what you're made of. I mean, that's where you go. You're a position coach and then you get a chance to coordinate, then maybe you could be a head coach. As to why he's struggling, my conversations with Wickline, I haven't talked to him since the beginning of the football season, even maybe a little bit before that. So I haven't talked to him about how this season's going, but I talked to him quite a bit last season about their struggles from last year. And it was that same thing. It was a cultural issue. Kids are different these days. He remarked to me one time that, he would yell at them in a meeting and they wouldn't even look at him in the eye, which is different from the past. You know, if he yelled at us in a meeting, we'd look at him like, hey, you know, let's go outside and fight in the hallway. And then that's exactly what he wanted. Daniel Koenig would start fights at practice just to smite Wick. You know, Wick would call us soft and, I wish I had a guy that would fight. And so Koenig would just start a fight in practice just to tell Wickline, hey, you don't know what you're talking about. That's what we were. And that's not what he has at Texas. And it's very apparent from their offensive line. And, if Cowboy fans are worried about our offensive line, we're a lot better off, guys. There's Oklahoma's offensive line is atrocious. Texas is atrocious. Trust me, we're not doing too bad.
Who do you feel like was the most underrated skill position player that you played with at Oklahoma State?
Underrated skill position player.
Like obviously Blackman was, clearly everybody knows he's really good. By the way, Carson, can you put your dog outside or something?
What's she doing? Do you hear it?
Yeah, it sounds like she's like drinking water or something.
I think she's done. Sorry. She's a German Shepherd. She's a big girl.
But no, yeah, an underrated skill position player that maybe people, maybe Oklahoma State fans like thought was okay, but you're like, man, that guy was really good.
I have to think about that. I think my senior year, that whole host of wide receivers that we had, everyone was kind of unsure of them, and they ended up being pretty good. I think the most underrated skilled player that could have made a much larger impact and could have, done so much more for Oklahoma State, but for whatever reason and his position just kind of got eliminated, Justin Horton. He was a tight end in back in the 2009 balanced, NFL-style offense that we ran. And when we started running, the Dana Holgorsen true air raid style, there's really no tight end. Now Monken fixed that, added in some heavy packages, but it was primarily blocking. But Justin Horton, you could ask any of those strength coaches, was a freak athlete, ridiculously fast, ridiculously strong, but one of the best people I know and very smart. He was actually one of the guys I coached with out in New Mexico Highlands and just a true coach, true leader. I can't say enough about the guy. I love him to death. But he, I guess, not really underrated. Just people never really knew about him because he never got a chance to do anything the last few years that we ran our air raid. Now, he started to do some inside receiver stuff, and he caught a couple passes. But then he, I'm not sure if you guys knew, but we started incorporating him into our offense quite a bit. We put in a lot of passes for him, and we started running him at the Iowa State game, and he had two huge catches right up the middle. and ended up destroying his Achilles tendon. I don't know if you guys remember that game.
Yeah.
We were wearing all orange. I found it with Oklahoma State guys. If you tell them what we were wearing, it helps identify. It was the first game we wore all orange.
That was homecoming, I think.
It was homecoming. Yeah, and he just completely destroyed his Achilles and effectively ended his football career.
Yeah.
So, you know, I hate to see that, but he, you know, was a guy that could have really made a difference for our team, just never got the chance.
You mentioned the Iowa State game. The 2011 season just seemed like a roller coaster. What was that year like, and what was it like going into that Iowa State game and everything that happened after that?
The whole year was a blast. I mean, we knew we were going to win. You know, we weren't surprised about anything except that Iowa State game. We knew that we just knew. We had too much. We had too good of an offensive system. We had too good of players. We knew that we were going to win every game. So the Iowa State game was kind of a shock. It was a weird Friday game, which no one really talks about, but no one really likes Friday games. That was kind of threw us off our system. Ames is not fun to play in. They have some of the worst AstroTurf in the country, the field turf. These are all stupid excuses, obviously. I'm just kind of leading up the thought process. You know, that was also the day that we found out about the plane crash with Kurt Budke and Miranda Serna. That was that same day. So, you know, that was tough for our coaching staff because, you know, I'm sure they knew them a lot better than the players did. But it just kind of seemed like there was just a dark cloud over the whole day. And, you know, we didn't really play that bad. I kind of honestly, I erased most of the game from my memory to help me be okay with my life. But I think most people did. But yeah, it was just a weird deal, and it was really unfortunate. I to this day think that Quinn Sharp's field goal went in. I think we got screwed on that, and I will get buried with that on my tombstone. But you know, that's just how it happens, and you know, we still got a chance to play for the Fiesta Bowl and beat Stanford, and you know, who knows, if we would have went to the national championship, obviously that would have been awesome. I think we would have destroyed LSU. But who knows, maybe we didn't, and then no one would remember us. So at least we got the Fiesta Bowl win. So I don't think there's anything to be ashamed of when looking back at that season. It was awesome to be a part of. You know, I have a 12.5-pound ring sitting on my dresser from it, so I can't be upset about any part of that season.
You mentioned earlier, and I've got two more questions, but you mentioned earlier about – the violence of playing offensive line. And then before that, you had mentioned the NFL, that you wanted to be able to walk and go to sleep at night and stuff. How much, like, when you're playing college football, do you think about the future in terms of, man, like, this could affect, like, my personal health for the rest of my life? Because I feel like that's become such a mainstream thing, but I'm like, do athletes in the moment, like, when they're in college, do you think about that in terms of the future?
No, I don't think anyone does. And here's why. We're as close as you can get. You know, maybe this is a little dramatic, but we're basically the modern version of gladiators. We're getting a chance to do something that a lot of people would love to be able to do. Mm-hmm. You know, I played football with a lot of good guys in high school that were great players, but they're just too small to ever play college football. You know, for whatever reason, I was big enough to do it. So that fact, you know, weighs a lot on. We know that, you know, we know that we're blessed to be able to do what we do. But bottom line is, we love it. You know, I didn't think one thing in football of whether there was going to be long term effects of me smashing my head on another guy's head 100 times a week. And even in the NFL, I don't think that people, maybe a little bit more in the NFL, but even to this day, if you go to those guys that are, you know, suing the NFL for concussions, and if you went back to them years before and told them that all this stuff could happen to you, but you're still going to make this amount of money, you're still going to get this glory, you're still going to have the greatest time of your life, but maybe you can, you know, have some problems, I guarantee 95% of them would still play.
Yeah.
You know, it's like smoke packets of cigarettes. They put all the warnings on it and people smoke. They don't care. It's the same thing. I mean, you could tell me, hey, Evan, you know, you might get a concussion and like maybe screw yourself up. okay, I'm going to go to practice now because I love it.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're young kids, teenagers, up to the 20s, 21, 22-year-old kids. You know, this is what we want to do. Playing football for Oklahoma State is, like, one of the highlights of my whole life, and I would never change that because, you know, I thought that I could, you know, get hurt later in life. Now, call me in a few years and then ask me the same question, maybe I'll change my story. But right now, I'm good.
This is more of a fact-finding mission for me. How do they pick the uniform combinations? They say there's, like, a committee, like Whedon got to pick. I don't know if that's true. What did you ever get to pick a combo, and how does it come about?
No one liked me in college. I didn't get to do anything. they tried to keep me away from as much as possible. To my best knowledge, I think they probably just asked a couple of the top players and then probably Gundy decides on his own. I knew that Blackman and Whedon had a big part in choosing a lot of those uniforms. You know, that was, like, the first year we had them.
Mm-hmm.
But my year, man, we just came in the locker room. There was combinations, and if we liked it, it was like, cool. If we didn't like it, we'd like, hey, Wes, what is this ridiculousness? But at this point, I wouldn't be surprised if Gundy's got, like, a spin wheel in his office and closes his eyes and just lets it run. That's at least what I want. That's at least what I want to believe.
Yeah, so that visual is spectacular.
Right? Let's go with that.
Okay, my last question. What is your – we asked Zach Robinson a variation of this, but what is your best Todd Monken story?
My best Todd Monken story?
That you can share.
Oh, man, that I can share. Now, that limits it. My best Todd Monken. There's like 1,000 amazing Todd Monken stories. Todd Monken is just one of, you know, there's those people that you meet in your life that you just will never forget, and you just love them, even if you never talk to them again. You know, I'll be telling my kid about Todd Monken one day. He's that person for me. He was just one of the most interesting, dynamic people. And when I got done playing and I wanted to get into coaching, he really tried to stick his neck out and help me get into coaching, which was tremendous. But my best Todd Monken story is how Levy and I used to sneak into his office and steal monsters. He had a secret monster refrigerator under his desk. See, Dana Holgerson was a Red Bull guy. What people don't know is that Todd Monken was a closet monster aholic, big time. So there's a lot of parallels between those two. But Monken, you know, covered up a little bit, you know, wore a hat so you didn't see his receding hairline. But he had monsters on deck, and when Levy and I got wind of this, we started stealing them on a pretty regular basis. And one day he caught us in there, and it was just kind of like, I didn't see you. You've got 12 seconds to get whatever monster you were going to get and get out of my office. And then after that, the monster refrigerator was gone. And it's one of the great Oklahoma State mysteries, guys, is where the monster refrigerator of 2011 went.
That sounds like a chapter in my book that I'm going to write in about 10 years.
I will read that.
Last question for me. You're bouncing your grandkids on your lap many years from now. What's the one story, moment, game you're going to be telling them about?
Definitely that Big 12 championship game that, you know, when we beat Oklahoma in 2011. You know, to win the Big 12, and we didn't just beat Oklahoma, we absolutely trashed Oklahoma. That was just the coolest experience. When everyone rushed the field, you know, that's college football for me. If I could sum up my college football career, like, that's what I immediately think of. You know, it took me 3 hours to get off the field, and everyone was just freaking out, and you just really kind of saw how special. It summed up how special Oklahoma State is in one instance. I mean, I have a picture of that on my computer background, and that just sums up our university for me perfectly, how excited everyone was. And, you know, OU fans can tote their record till the day they die. But that happened. I got to experience it, and it was absolutely amazing. So that's my story for that.
Yeah, I think for a lot of people that are affiliated with OSU, that was, you know, that was the moment. So, oh, by the way, somebody wrote in on Twitter and asked who's the sexiest offensive lineman to ever play for Oklahoma State.
Oh, someone did? Someone wrote that in, huh? Oh. Well, I can't remember his name.
It was at Evan Epstein 60. You heard of him?
this guy's got a great Twitter feed. We should all go follow him. Now, there was an offensive lineman a few years ago, just the most beautiful man hair you've ever seen. Visions reminiscent of Thor, I would probably say. I think his name was Evan Epstein. He was pretty sexy, guys.
Well, Evan Epstein, we really appreciate you you coming on and visiting with us. And
you thank guys, you, thank you.
Everybody should follow him, Evan Epstein 60 on Twitter. Some great stuff, I presume, throughout the rest of the year.
And, yes, I will do my best to live tweet as many games. Yeah. Hopefully, things get a little bit better. I can maybe make it through the entire game without having some kind of heart attack scare.
Don't make mom mad at you.
I won't. I won't.
Well, we'll definitely have you on later in the year, man, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. I really, really appreciate the opportunity. You guys are some of my favorite people to listen to on podcasts and Twitter and all that stuff, and you make me feel better about the things I tweet, so thank you.
Thanks, Evan. Appreciate it, man.
All right. Yeah. Have a good one.
All right.
Well, Kyle, Evan Epstein had a lot to say.
Yeah, he's awesome. When are we starting our radio show with him?
Like, we're just going to – the podcast from now on is going to be just him with an open microphone, and we're just going to get out of the way, I think. It's the best course of action.
I do like that his affiliate, like the way he sees us, is making him feel better about the stuff he tweets. I'm glad that I can bring that levity to people's life like that.
Yeah, he's a must follow for sure. And the biggest takeaway I had from him was A, how much he cares still about Oklahoma State, and yeah. B, that 2011 team. Like I told you last week, like, they didn't think they were losing. Like, there was no, like, that wasn't even, like, a possibility. And that really came across when he was talking about that team.
Yeah. I mean, it's the I haven't watched it yet, but the USC-Texas documentary where Matt Leinart was talking about we never thought we would lose, ever. And
yeah.
I think that was kind of the reference that we made to the Oklahoma State team. But I was struck, really, by how two things. How much affection he had for Joe Wickline and the guys he played with. I think that is maybe more rare than he thinks it is, and maybe not. I didn't play college football or anything, but I thought that was really cool. And then he made me miss Todd Monken. I mean, he really did. Like just everything about it.
Oh, it's clear to me Todd Monken's just the best. Like the monster fridge. Are you kidding me? Of course he drinks Monster and not Red Bull. Like, doesn't that make sense?
It's perfect. And it was really interesting because I thought what he said about the Dana Holgorsen offense being designed for bad players, or at least average players, not bad players. And then Monken coming in saying, yeah, this is great, but we've got, I've got Wes Lunt. I've got
Joe Randall, NFL.
Yeah, exactly. Like, let's amp this up a little bit. I mean, that is exactly how it went, and I didn't even really, I guess, realize that at the time. And it makes you think about how smart Todd Monken was, you know?
Yeah, and it makes you want to start printing those Make Oklahoma State Air Raid T-shirts again. Like, it's clear to me, you know, he mentioned Gundy when he was the offensive coordinator, how they ran, like, you know, more pro-style power system in 2009. Well, that's what they're back to now. So it's clear to me, just in hearing him talk, like that's a Gundy thing. And for whatever reason, they're not running the same offense they used to. And he kind of expressed a lot of the same concerns we had, you know, with Mason Rudolph can throw it. The receivers are great. So he really gave us an inside perspective on what we've been talking about the last few weeks.
I think let's just turn the podcast over to him and he can host it and have people on.
Evan Epstein firing.
Yeah.
Podcast.
I like it. Epstein's firing. He can have Todd Monken on. He's or Wickline or somebody.
He's spectacular. We'll definitely have to have him on later in the year for sure. Do we have time for Twitter questions? We're running long here.
I don't know. We're at like 50 minutes. Let's talk about just this weekend. What are you? I mean, Oklahoma State's off, but what else are you looking forward to this weekend?
Well, I'm going to the Little Apple, Manhattan, Kansas, to cover OU. We're doing a post-game show on ABC, so I'm looking forward to that. Harbaugh, dude, I'm all in on Harbaugh. I have been since his Stanford days. But
you've been all in on him since he changed San Francisco's uniforms.
Well, that was a key. But even just turning Stanford was horrible when he got there. He turned them into an NFL team. And, like, to me, he's the best living college football coach, any level.
Wow. We did, like, six podcasts ago, we gave that to, we gave that title to Urban Meyer, didn't we?
Well, yeah, you might be right.
like literally 6 weeks ago, we said, or one of us said.
Well, as far as, like, achievements and resume, Urban Meyer's the best. But if you give me one coach to build a program, turn around a program, it's got to be Harbaugh. And I would even say if you put Harbaugh at Ohio State, they might be even better than they are now. I mean, he's that good. Now, he will wear his guys out, and so is Urban Meyer. But you look at what he's done at the college and NFL level. He won at San Diego. San Diego didn't even have, like, a football program. He went over there and won. The guy's incredible.
Yeah. He has been good. They got Michigan State this weekend?
Michigan State. That's the marquee game.
Where's it at?
It's at Ann Arbor. Game day is going to be there.
That's going to be interesting because Michigan State's not been great. Can we talk about how Oklahoma State is going into – they basically got two bye weeks, although they've played Kansas close two of the last 3 years. But they've got bye week and then Kansas. They're probably going to be undefeated going to Texas Tech on Halloween. That's insane, right?
I know. And, like, for all – like, we've talked bad, like, isn't that, like – ideal? Like, isn't the season going fine? Like, as much as we've bashed the offense and talked about, you know, Mike Yurcich's play calling, like, it's only happened, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 times previously that they've been 7-0?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think
fewer.
Or is it 8-0? Maybe. I can't remember.
I think it's fewer than 5 times because – I think in 97, they lost their 7th game.
Okay.
So this is the 6th Oklahoma State team to get to 6-0. I don't know how many have gotten to 7-0. I know 2011, obviously.
I have the list here. It's 1945, 1997, 2008, 2010, 2011. And I don't know about...
The 2010 team got to 7-0?
No, they started 6-0, then lost to Nebraska.
Yeah, that's
maybe 6-0 is the stat.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
But that reminds me, in 1997, I don't know about you, but as a kid, like, seeing, like, number 21 next to, like, Oklahoma State's name was, like, the coolest thing ever. I don't know about you. Like, they hadn't been ranked, like, my whole life. In, like, 97, they were finally ranked. I'd, like, oh, my God, they have a number next to their name. This is crazy.
I think that my family spent possibly like 6 days in San Antonio at the Alamo Bowl.
They were there a week.
It was like the greatest thing that had happened since I was like able to remember Oklahoma State things. I mean, it was
Alamo Bowl was like the Super Bowl.
Yeah, it was. and they who was the quarterback on that Purdue team?
That was Drew Brees.
No, was it?
I want to say it was. Was it not?
I don't know. It was somebody that was. I feel like Purdue had another quarterback around that time that was really good in college. Maybe it was Drew Brees.
That was before Drew Brees. You're right. College career. Let's see here.
This is great radio, by the way.
Let me look it up. Yeah, Brees played in like 2000.
Yeah.
So my bad. Should I look up 1997 Purdue while we're at it?
Yeah, go ahead, because I want to remember.
But, like, seriously, though, like, until that point, like up until 1997, like, them being ranked was, like, it shows you really how far along Oklahoma State football has come. Like, I don't want to be that. Expectations have changed, for sure. I don't want to be that guy. But, like, it is crazy. Like, in 1997, we were just happy to see, like, 21 next to their name.
Their quarterback Brees was on that team. Maybe Brees played in the Alamo Bowl that year because he was on that team. But they had a guy named Billy Dicken.
No, surely not.
That was his name, Billy Dicken. He threw for 3,000 yards, 21 touchdowns. So that's definitely not who I was thinking of.
The memorable Billy Dicken. Legendary.
Maybe Brees did play in that Alamo Bowl because he threw... he only had 43 attempts, so that would have been the only game he played in if he did.
Nah, that wasn't him. Yeah. Mainly it was just their offense, I guess. But,
yeah.
But it just – wow, we're doing some serious old man radio here. But no, that was pretty crazy. Mike Gundy turned down USC. He basically said he's not going.
Whatever. I mean.
What, they beating down his door?
No. I mean, and it's like, I don't know. The whole thing is just silly. Like, with I hate it when teams either fire coaches or coaches leave, and then these lists pop up of like, yeah, no crap. Like, somebody would want Bob Stoops to come coach their team. Like, yes, but it's like, what are we even talking about here? Like, that's not, you said it best, going back to Texas, Charlie Strong, best, most realistic candidate that Texas could have gotten. Like, let's be realistic. Like, Bob Stoops is not going to USC. Mike Gundy's not going to USC. Like, this is not 1983 where USC is like the one of the five jobs that people would do anything to you know, to get, to leave their school for. So I don't know. I hate stuff like that.
Yeah, and I saw like Bob Stoops like linked to the South Carolina job. You want to talk about a step down, going from OU to South Carolina. Like, it's not happening.
Which, by the way, I don't know if we've ever talked about this, but Frank Martin going from Kansas State to South Carolina in basketball?
Yeah, they're about the same program, aren't they?
I mean, I guess. Like,
basketball?
I don't understand.
K-State's never been any good.
Yeah, but I don't understand lateral moves like that, like Bielema going from Wisconsin to Arkansas.
Well, that's just like you hate your boss, so you're just going to go, you know, to the next best job you can get at the time.
Yeah,
that's kind of, and you liked my tweet where I thought Gundy said it on the USC, being a USC candidate, it shows that OSU is for real and that Gundy is a wanted man. From quote from Bill Haysen. I thought Mike Gundy said that, and I didn't even like bat an eyelash. Like, I didn't even like that sounds right, but actually Mason Rudolph said it.
I laughed so hard when I saw that tweet because I could picture you reading it and just being like, oh yeah, that's something Gundy would say.
Gundy went third person on us. No big deal.
Oh, that's good stuff. Okay, we need to wrap this up.
We've almost gone an hour. We'll save the Twitter questions for next week.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, again, we appreciate Evan coming on. It was a lot of fun, and I get to enjoy a stress-free college football weekend.
Yeah, I'll be driving through the purgatory that is Kansas. So you enjoy that time on the couch.
I will. Enjoy yourself. Be safe.
All right, man. We'll catch up next week.
Okay. Talk to you later.
See ya.